Invite you to turn with me, if you will, to 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 11. We come to a passage this morning which we're going to be considering for the next 2 weeks, which I believe is one of the most crucial passages for all of us to come to terms with. It is a passage that has often been restricted to other people because for some reason we remove ourselves from it, and yet it is so, so crucial. Fact of the matter is, making a comment the other day, if I am not prepared for this message, I will never be prepared for any message. I have been writing an article on this passage that is going to be published in the next couple of months and just completed it this last week. And didn't time it this way, but by God's grace it is this way. It is a passage that has been avoided because so many of the issues dealt with here are placed onto somebody else. We're going to look at it this morning, but let me back off for a bit before we deal with the passage itself, just to talk about us. You know, one of the most important things that we need to realize is what church is really meant to be, what church is, what church was from its very inception. It is so easy for us to make church a part of a business type thing. And I remember years ago, and some will bear testimony to that. It was over 5 years ago in beginning ministry with some of the men who are here, and my first contact with them, my statement to them that our role together as those who are leaders was not about doing business, it was about relationships. It is what it's all about. We so often lose sight of that. It's dangerous. And in the process of our much doing for God, we forget that the primary issue is about relationships. It's first of all about relationship with God. In the midst of all of our business and serving God, and I recall a pastor who years ago fell to immorality, and he says, you know where it all started? He said, it started when I got so tied up in the busyness of the ministry, and I stopped having that personal relationship with God. You can do the greatest job in the world of preaching, visiting, whatever else in the world you want to do, and it can look good to everybody else, but if you've lost the primary relationship with God, it may look good to everybody else, but it just has lost its value and its purpose. Is it not also a relationship with Jesus Christ? And again, to separate those two, don't like to, but a relationship with God and a relationship with Jesus Christ. And certainly the whole essence of Christianity is just that, is it not? Right? Come unto me. It is that personal relationship. Even if you go back into Exodus, interesting, Exodus 19, where, you know, the issue of that, even at that point where God is calling Israel out, is reminding them that the purpose of their calling was a relationship with himself. It is not changed. It doesn't matter whether it's Old Testament, New Testament. God has forever been calling us unto relationship. And the whole issue of salvation is a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. So that when God sets down the roles, the responsibilities of leadership within the church, and what's required for people to be leaders, look at it. It is primarily about what? Relationships. You want to find out whether a person's qualified to be a leader in the church or not? Don't ask about how well he does in the context of the church or in the context of his business. Go find out what he does in his home. That's what it says. How does he relate with his wife? What is that relationship like? How does he relate with his children? What is that relationship like? Look at the requirements. It's what it is. A man must be a one-woman man. It's about relationships. And if he doesn't qualify in those relationships, he had not ought to have leadership in this kind of a ministry. Why? Because the whole ministry is about relationships, and it all begins with how do you relate to God? How do you relate to Jesus Christ? How do you relate to your wife? It's about relationships. It's what it is. And we can carry on the business of church for so long and fail in those relationships. And I think what I have learned over the last 12 to 14 years through circumstances that have come is that, you see, it is not about the job. It became so eminently clear to me. The primary issue of my life was my relationship with my God and my relationship with my wife. Frankly, I got to tell you, the rest of it doesn't even matter to me. In one sense, that's what matters. The rest of it will grow out of that, but that's what matters. And in the midst of all the turmoil that comes, you just come back to saying, this is where it is. This is where it is. What is my relationship like with God? What is my relationship like with my wife? For on that, everything is built. And without that, nothing really matters a whole bunch. One of the largest mission organizations in the world, best known, I should say that, probably a better term, one of the best known mission organizations in the world, started by a man who was a driven man, known everywhere, known in the political scene in this country and around the world, in country after country after country. And in the process of all of this, sacrificed the relationship with his wife and his kids. And his one daughter, who has grown now, has written a book that reflects the bitterness and the anguish of that which her father put all of them through because, you see, he was successful in ministry but failed in that primary of all relationships, see, the relationship with God and with his family and with his wife. Well, I talk about relationships today because it's so crucial as you come to this point in this book. It is a relationship Paul has with the people that he implores them to have with him. And it's interesting because as we'll look at it this week and next week, we think that we know what the problems are that keep us from having the kind of relationship. And yet, as Paul will address it in this passage, I think so often we fail to understand what the true problem is that keeps us from having this kind of relationship. The issue of the passage has to do with transparency. And I don't want you to impose upon this passage your image of transparency. Let this passage impose upon you its own image. Because we have ideas of transparency these days, but you know, we sort of think it's a newfound thing that just sort of came on the scene and it has not been around too long, but we sort of invented it. We didn't. It has been there for a long, long time, and Paul, in no other book, does he evidence the kind of transparency he evidences in this book, 2 Corinthians. It's all the way through the book. It starts in chapter 1, goes all the way through to chapter 12, and then he concludes in chapter 13 with things that grow out of that. Unbelievable openness, incredible openness and transparency. But it didn't begin with him, did it? And one of the, you know, I reflect back to the Old Testament to a man that many of us, you know, we look at and we call him the weeping prophet. And we know so little about him, yet one of the longest books in the Bible, the man Jeremiah. Transparent, you do not find any more transparent author in the Old Testament, likely unless you would go to the Psalms and you find amazing transparency there. But just in one of those kinds of prophetic books, nobody as transparent as he was. And I would say to those of you who are men here today, the essence of transparency, you see, you watch a man like this, true men cry. This is a man who was called the weeping prophet because he was a man who was given to tears and given to anguish of soul, given to the openness of expression, you see, and true men do this. people who think they are men and choose not to do this are not truly men and have not really gained the ability to be all that they can be if they would only let themselves be expressive in those relationships that God has enabled them to have. But Jeremiah was one. And I've never forget Jonah as I read through one time and reflecting on why in the world, you know, you understand the first three chapters of the book. Because the first chapter is sin and other people witness this. The third chapter, anybody write on because it's a great revival in Nineveh and you watch God work, and so that is not a problem. Chapter two, you have to have in there because how did you get from the water and the fish to the city of Nineveh? So somewhere there. But chapter four is totally inexplicable. There's no reason why it should exist. In one sense. It is only Jonah and God and a tree. And it died. It's only Jonah and God. And why in the world do you have to tell the story about how you bombed and how you did so poorly in your response and how you reacted in a way you should never have reacted? Who even, you know, why? You see, Jonah was willing to share that with us so that we might not go through what he went through. So this isn't new. I mean, it's not something that just got invented yesterday. This has been around. And this passage is filled with a sense of the transparency that has to be if you and I are going to have the relationships that we need to have in the body of Jesus Christ. God required, God demanded, God desired relationships. Now, as you look at this, it is easily defined for us. You can't miss as you look at this because Paul defines this. And by the way, let me show you how this works just for a bit. What Paul does, if you read with me in chapter 6, verses 11 to 13, then I will move right into chapter 7, verse 2, because these passages fit together, and what is in between we'll look at next week. Now, just read with me. Chapter 6, verse 11, our mouth is spoken freely to you, O Corinthians. Our heart is open wide. You are not restrained by us, but you are restrained in your own affection. Now, in like exchange, I speak as to children, open wide to us also. 7:2. Make room for us in your hearts. We wronged no one. We corrupted no one. We took advantage of no one. I do not speak to condemn you, for I have said before that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. Great is my confidence in you. Great is my boasting on your behalf. I'm filled with comfort. I'm overflowing with joy in all of our affliction. Now, let me first of all talk to you about the nature of this transparency. And just as it's defined in this passage, and you cannot miss the nature of it, and Paul models it in this passage. Notice he starts out in verse 11 of chapter 6, and he says, our mouth has spoken freely to you. It is a good rendition of the statement. It is a perfect tense, okay? What we talk about, perfect tense. Perfect tense has to do with an action that happened in the past and its results continue. And so basically what he was saying here, my mouth stands open. There is no doubt all this is saying is that you can see it for the last five chapters of this book. I have been open to share with you my heart, my life, and I'm going to keep on doing it all the way through the end of this book. And there's an openness of sharing in Paul's communication with them. My mouth stands open. I didn't just open up and share with you. This is a nature of my life. It's a nature of my ministry. It's a nature of my relationship with you. I have an opened mouthed relationship. Just read this book. Read in so many others of Paul's writings, and especially places like Galatians, and you cannot miss this sense of Paul's opened mouthed relationship. My mouth stands open to you. You know, there are a lot of things that you share in the openness. What he shared in this book, he shared several things. I mean, it's amazing how open he is. And he makes statements that some of us tend not to want to make. In fact, some of them that we fight making because somehow we think, well, that's just Paul and we can't be this way. And you know what? I am learning. It may take me, and I hope I learn a bit more before I die. But the sense of being more open to say some of the things that Paul would say and not apologize for saying them. An openness to communicate, an openness to express. He expressed the pains. We allude to that in Galatians 4. He says, you know what? He says, I mean, the pain that was there. He says, you cannot know what kind of pain I feel. And when I read this, I got to tell you, I was teaching through Galatians in a class years ago. And in teaching it, I got to this chapter and I had a hard time with it. It didn't fit my model of Paul. And I'd been in the ministry for 20 years at that time. Because he says, you know what? You love me. He says, you treated me as Jesus, as you would Christ himself. You would have plucked out your eyes from me. And now just because some people have said something, you've turned against me. And then he makes this statement. He says, I want to be kindly affectioned by you, not only when I'm present, but when I'm away. I want you to like me. I think it doesn't sound like a man that I would have made him out to be. But that's what he was like. And he expressed the deepness of his pain. But you know, that takes a bit of doing. But he expressed also, though, the elation of watching God work through his life and talking about things that God did. And he talks about those things in the ministry of how they imitated him and how the ministry was so impactful. And I think to myself that that's one of the most difficult things for me. It was tough to come to that place where with Paul I would identify the pain and the suffering, because I recall starting a ministry many years ago now. And I remember the very beginning because I had had so much hurt and pain in some things that had happened in childhood. I was determined no one ever hurt me again. And in the early years of ministry, so hardened myself from hurt. I just did not want it to happen. I wanted to brace my heart and soul and keep the tenderness of what was inside from being damaged by somebody else. And in ministry, so easy to have happen. And to find a way that this would be openly expressed. And I've shared, I remember in class, we spend a lot of time praying for people, and I enjoy bearing the burdens of others. But why it stands out so much is because it was so much against where I was when a student one day, and I remember his name to this day, puts his hand up at the beginning of class and he says, you know, we appreciate the fact you pray for us, but have you nothing for which we can pray for you? We prayed so quickly that day because there was no way. I mean, me, their professor, share with them the hurts of my soul? By God's grace, I do today. My first lecture in the fall every year is that you can choose to be open in this class if you will, but I make a commitment that I will be open with you. And I remember going through one of the hardest times of my life and someone making a statement out of context saying, you know, well, you announced that in class. No, I didn't announce it in class. I say stuff in class that I might not say anywhere else because God has placed me with some men that I'm going to be with for 9 months, but I'm going to talk to you about it. We're together for life, but God has placed us together. And I make a statement at the very beginning of class. I finally learned you need me, but I also need you. Boy, it took me a long time to get there. But you see, it is not just about the pain part of it. It's even the other part of it, to talk about the exciting parts of ministry where you sense God doing something and God using you and God powerfully blessing. And you're afraid to say something because it will sound like it's boastful, prideful, whatever. And there's a hard thing to somehow do. And yet Paul does. And I would suggest to you that the openness of Paul's heart, and we cannot go through all of it, is certainly the opening of the pain of his life, but also the blessings of ministry. And knowing that, you see, those are the things that can be shared. And I remember a day of ministry where God powerfully worked, and I just knew I had to do it. And I went home and I just decided three men I was going to call. And it was the hardest thing in the world. And when I called one of them, he gave me a put down. I remember his name. He's a good friend. Because he couldn't handle it. He could not handle the positive statement I would make to him. And so he had to come back with some kind of a put down because he didn't know how to receive it. And we're that way, are we not? Huh? Someone says something positive to us and we don't know how to take it. And so as you look at this, you know, he comments about this. And he says, first of all, he says, I got to tell you something. My mouth stands open to you, O Corinthians. And by the way, lest you should fail to see this, when he says, O Corinthians here, do you realize that rarely, this is such a tender moment because rarely does he express himself this way to anybody. He talks about, O Galatians, he does it one other place. This is the only time in all his writings he refers them this way because it's a very endearing statement he's making to them. But then comes a second statement. You see, this kind of a relationship is a relationship that is willing to share the heart. But notice something. Verse 11, the latter part, our heart is open wide. This is also perfect tense. And in fact, this is what's going to cause him in verse 13 to say to them, I speak as to children, open wide to us also. Chapter 7, verse 2, make room for us in your heart. Chapter 7, verse 3, I have said before that you are in our hearts. You know, it is one thing for us to open our mouth and learn to somehow say to others, this is the pain of my soul. The other thing is, it's tough for us to open our hearts and be responsive to the pain of the souls of others. Many of us, it doesn't matter whether we're men or women, we might share with other people our own burdens, but you know what? We are very prone not to sit down and respond to the pains and burdens of others. I have you in my heart. My heart stands open. And in fact, my plea to you, he says, please open up to me. Please. You guys are accusing me of stuff. In fact, he's going to address that. Notice, he says in chapter 7, the response to them, and these are against charges that have been given against him. He says, we, verse 2, have wronged no one. We've corrupted no one. We took advantage of no one. In fact, it is emphatic in here, and the no one is first. No one have we wronged. No one have we corrupted. No one have we taken advantage of. And see, in the midst of all of this, they're bringing accusations against him. And he says, guys, back off. Number one, the accusations aren't true. But number two, he says, stop this stuff. And have a heart that is open to me as I have a heart that is open to you. I wonder if we sit here today, you know, we're so selfish, we are unbelievably selfish. When we get together so often, it is our desire to share what we have to say with other people and not to listen to what they have to say. In early years of ministry, to think that the role that I had was to be setting everybody else straight or helping them out with their problem, not just sitting there and listening, and how I have learned over the years, far better often just to sit and to listen and to respond and to be there and not to say anything for that matter. A heart that stands open. And you cannot have the relationship. For many people who move out to say, all right, I'm going to try this business, and they open up to express, and then they are cut off by somebody who can't accept what they have to say by just listening and responding. And it is something to be learned, as we somehow will just open our hearts to other people and respond to their burdens, their pains, their hurts, their anguish, and their joy. Notice something else about this too, though. It is active support of one another. And when we have these relationships, they certainly have to be this. If you go to chapter 7, you'll see this. When he deals with this, he deals in chapter 7 with his relationship with them. And notice what he does. And I'm amazed in this book. In fact, the matter is, these verses are difficult in light of what some would assess 1 Corinthians to be. Notice what he says to them in this passage. He says in verse 4, great is my confidence in you. Now, you know, when we think about having confidence in somebody else, and some of us do not exude confidence in other people. We have confidence in what we can do, but not confidence in what they can do. And you know, it's not really about confidence in what they can do either. It's confidence in what God will do in them and through them. I mean, this is Corinth, mind you, and this is this book, 2 Corinthians, just written a few months after the other book. So don't think this is years later, all of a sudden there's a major change in their life. These are the same people. And I hear people describe 1 Corinthians and the church of Corinth as being this kind of a church, and they got all these negative things. You look at this book and you sense what Paul says. He says, I have great confidence in you. I think of this in relationship with my own children, the need to enable them to understand the confidence that I have in them. Sharing the other day, there's a fellow I met in ministry in Northern California. He was over 50, worked with his dad in the same business, the business out of San Francisco. In all of his years, not once has his dad ever said a positive statement to him or about him in his presence, ever. The only way he's ever heard anything this way is by other men in the business that his dad has said something to about his abilities, and then it came back to him. But in 50 years, never had a compliment from his father, never had any expression of the confidence his dad had in him. I remember complimenting a young fellow in class one day, and it wasn't even that great a compliment, actually. It wasn't like he was an A student. And he came back to see me that afternoon. He says, I had to come back. He says, you know what? Never in my life has anyone ever paid me a compliment. I says, talk to me. He was right in the middle of 21 children. I ask him, I says, same mother. He says, same mother. I says, how is she? He says, like any mother. And I says, oh, no, she's not. I guarantee you that. You know, that sense of doing this, and you look at these statements Paul makes. Notice the next statement, and we'll come back to this one too, but notice the next statement he makes. Great is my boasting on your behalf. In fact, look down further in the very same passage. He's talking to Titus. You know, what he was encouraged by Titus, notice in verse 13. Of chapter 7. Besides our comfort, we rejoiced even much more for the joy of Titus, because the Spirit has been refreshed by you all. That's a southern if I ever heard, by y'all. This is down, now this is Corinth, mind you, notice. For if in anything I have boasted to him about you, I was not put to shame. You know what? This is a man who boasted about the church of Corinth, and he told Titus, this is an incredible church, and he comes back from visiting them and he says, you know what? In everything I spoke this way about you, you didn't put me to shame. Now the confidence, you see, this is a church that was not a perfect church. Now you say, well, I can't boast and I can't have confidence if there's this kind of sin and problems in a church. Oh, yes, you can. And you see, we don't need perfection in each other's lives for people to say, great is my confidence in you. Great is my boasting in your behalf. We don't need perfection for that. We understand that what he was confident in wasn't just what they would do, but what God would do in them, through them, for them, by them. So much of the confidence we have in each other is a confidence in God, not necessarily just in each other. And for many of us who cannot have this confidence in each other is because we do not have that confidence in God. Sat with someone this past week talking, and I says, you know what, you have to do two things. You need to trust your child, number one, and you need to trust God, number two. And they're not separable items. You know, we want to have a relationship with each other. It's the openness of mouth and heart, but it's also that sense of supporting one another with these kinds of feelings and statements, not that demand perfection. But notice the statement. It says in verse 4, I am filled with comfort. And I do think the word comfort can be comfort or encouragement. And I do think the word is encouragement in this sense. I am filled with encouragement. But notice something as you look at this. You see the sense in this passage, there's confidence in them. There's boasting about them. And by the way, I again remind you, you may say to other people how much confidence you have in somebody. Do you go to that person and tell them? There's too little of that among us. You see, one of the things I find about Paul, he says, I thank God, you know, he starts, then he lists all these things about them he thanks God for. You see, the nice thing about Paul, he didn't just express thanksgiving and gratitude to God for people, but he went to those people and told them that he was expressing the gratitude and thanksgiving. It is not good enough that you and I tell everybody else about somebody. We need to go tell that somebody about them. My dear father-in-law used to say, son, he says, pass out the flowers before it's too late. You know, we used to do a thing in one church on Mother's Day. It was something we started, and on Father's Day, both in the evening. We would actually honor different people. And I remember one time it was a family, and we had, the mother was a godly lady, and we had the family come up, and it was a surprise to her. She had no idea, and she gets to church and these people speak, but it wasn't a matter of trying to exalt the person, but to evidence to a congregation the kind of godly woman that one ought to be, or the kind of godly man one ought to be. And the family, for some of you know, was the Sutherland family. And the woman we were honoring was Mrs. Sutherland. And she was so humble and she was so moved by what happened. But the family said, never have we had this opportunity to express publicly our feeling concerning our mother. You know, it's nice sometimes when before people die, we can stop and say these kinds of things about each other and say it to their face and say it to others so that everybody knows the kind of feelings we have. And you know, this business of, you know, God, you keep them humble, we'll keep them poor kind of stuff. Listen to me. It is God's business to keep people humble, not yours. And so many times we're reticent to say something because we think, well, the pride will, you know, don't worry about the pride. That's not your problem. We have a need to do what Paul does and to express it. So he does it here. He says, great is my confidence, great is my boasting. You fill me with encouragement. And in fact, by the way, that's a perfect tense. I am in the state of being filled with encouragement by you. And if that's not enough, go back with me to verse 3. I have said before that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. You know, if we're going to have the kind of relationship that's necessary, it must be a relationship that is severed only by death. Oh, we're so fickle. I mean, it is not new. It's not new. The fickleness was true. They said, Hosanna, one week, and they cried, crucify him the next. Did they not, right? You understand, human beings are basically very, very fickle. We just are. Unbelievably fickle. This is a part of human nature. That's why Paul says, you treat me as Christ himself. You would have plucked out your eyes. Now you've turned against me. In fact, the matter is, he says, when I came to Galatia, I didn't even want to stay there anyhow. But I was so sick, I stayed there, and you treated me, you cared for me. Even in the midst of that, you did, and you loved me so much. Why? Can't figure out the why. My friend, that can happen in the world, but it should not happen in the church. Corinth, I have a commitment. I will live together with you, and I will die together with you. I believe very strongly, you see, is God has brought us together in this body. It's a lifelong relationship. It doesn't end. Other people that God has allowed me to pour my life into in the past, it didn't end when that church experience ended. It is a forever relationship. And in fact, as I go back over my ministry, I could not tell you as it goes to the thing, you know, the success of this church, success of that church, but I got to tell you, the relationships. And I can list you the men into whose life God has enabled me to pour my life, and watching them as God turned their life around, and today watching their lives as they walk with God. And that's the essence of it. And you know, it's a relationship that will last till we die. See, we don't put ourselves together. God puts us together. And Paul says this is a relationship that is till we die. To live together with, to die together with. Now, I got to tell you, if we're going to start and just stop at this point and just say, all right, where are we? This is what we need to have. This is what Paul had. This is what he implores them to have. This kind of an open mouth, open heart, supporting relationship that is not to be severed by anything but death itself. Now notice, as you go to this, notice, is there a need for this? And I got to tell you, you can answer this for yourself, but you know, there would not be this pleading in chapter 6, verse 13, I speak as to children, open wide to us. There would not be the plead in chapter 7, verse 2, make room for us in your heart, if this wasn't a need in the church of Corinth. And I got to tell you something, it's a need in the church here in America today, or anywhere else, if you will. You know, one of the things we don't want to be treated as, and anywhere else outside of here, we're treated as a number, right? And I remember going to the mission field, and somebody had introduced me to an insurance agent. First time I called him up, and I said, I got this car. And first, I've never had a car before. I called him up, I said, I have this car, I need to be insured. He says, all right, you're insured. I said, just like that? He says, just like that. My brother got him for an insurance agent. He went on his honeymoon, and the first day out, they had an accident, totaled the car. He called the guy. The check was in the mail within 2 days. Boy, he's a nice guy. Went to mission field, came back, and I called the same company. I think, this is great. I want this guy. No, we don't do it that way anymore. What does your name start with? Oh, my name starts with an M. Okay, you get so-and-so, right? And now it's what it is, okay? There's nothing, this personal stuff, and it's lost. And outside of here, we're a number. We don't want to come to church to be a number. I was in Montana ministering and sat at a table with this lady in a home, and she left the church because she said, I've been in that church for 20 years. And one day, one of the leaders is talking to her and say, well, now what is your number kind of stuff? And she says, that was it for me, you know. They can have this kind of a thing where they do it. And by the way, the offering envelopes are coming, and you do know it, yeah. But you know what? We're not about numbers, are we? I hope we're not about numbers. We're about people. We're about relationships. We're not about these kind of statistics. It's what's out there. It's not what needs to be in here. And now what holds us up and what keeps it from happening? Go with me, if you will. And then let me just talk about some things in this passage that hinder this kind of relationship with one another. And I got to tell you, as you start out this business and look at this passage, you see that there are several things that do it. The hindrances to this kind of relationship. First of all, I got to tell you what it is fear. You know, Paul is writing, and this is the context of this book. Paul is writing to a church, and this whole thing, this whole section, chapter 2, verse 14 through 7, verse 14, is sandwiched in a whole book that's dealing with defending himself against accusations. This book is the most open book, and yet the most defensive book of any book he's ever written. From chapter 1, the section on comfort, all the way to the very end, he is defending himself against these people who are ripping, 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 ripping. And you know, when people rip, that we don't want to open ourselves up and make ourselves more vulnerable to ripping people. Right? And you would think that the church that you're defending yourself against the most would be the church that you would say the least to, because then you give them more ammunition. And many of us, you know the problem with this, we like to think that our problem is not us related. Fact of the matter is, go back with me just for a while to chapter 6, just for a while. Look at this. Look at verse 12, if there's a statement that begins all of this. You are not restrained by us. You know, and then he goes back in chapter 7, verse 2, we wronged no one, we corrupted no one, we took advantage of no one. You know, the problem, he says, is not me. And some of you think that the reason why you can't have an open relationship with me is because there's something wrong with me. He says, no, the problem's not with me. You know, for many of us who don't have this kind of relationship, and I know for myself, okay, I can go back and say, you know, well, you see, you understand, because of this that happened in my life, because of this that happened in my life, because of this that happened in my life, therefore, because of this, that's who I am, you see, and I can't help it. And you see, it's not my fault, it's everybody else's fault, and we live in that kind of society that wants to put the blame on everybody else and say, I didn't do it. Paul says, huh, you did do it. You understand? The problem isn't in a relationship that we have with each other. The problem isn't somebody else. The problem is you. I think for all of us, we need to stop and say, hold it. It isn't everybody else that's got the problem. I have the problem. See, I cannot affect what you do to me, but I can affect how I respond to you, right? Remember someone saying, no one can give you a bad self-image unless you let them. And Paul's initial statement, he says, you know, the problem with it is we start out with this thinking the problem is somebody else. The problem, he says, is you. He says, you're not restraining your affections because of me. And you want to put the blame on me and say, you did this, you did this, you did this. He says, I didn't do it, but he says, I'm not the fault. He says, you are restrained inside in your own affections. And I think for all of us, we need to start out to understand if there is not an openness of relationship, it's not because the world has treated us wrong. And by the way, if in the process of doing this you think, well, you know what, I'm not going to do this because, you know what, do you think that you're hurting everybody else because you fail to function this way? Right? When you and I fail to function this way, the only person we're really hurting is whom? Ourselves. We cut ourselves off from that which we could have. And Paul says, you cut yourself off from relationship with me, and the fault is not with me. The fault lies inside of you. And for many of you, you see, the issue is a matter of fear because you're afraid what somebody's going to do with what you give. And Paul just keeps opening up and opening up and opening up to a church that wants to rip. Remember a man. He was great at starting churches, and I was in his church in North Vancouver, North Vancouver in British Columbia. My wife, we'd never been to the church. We'd been invited to come speak, and we moved into a motel on Wednesday because my wife was going to speak there, so she went and spoke to the women. Then she came back home, and she says, I don't know what it is, but there's something painfully wrong with that church. I changed what I was going to do. I only spoke there twice. Spoke there on Friday night, I think, and Sunday morning. When I got through on Sunday morning, a young man came, and just his wife was standing there, his kids, and he hugged me, and he says, thanks for being there for my dad. Well, his dad was the pastor, and somebody had been, a pastor who had failed another church, he'd come to this church determined to destroy him, and he drove him out of the church. The man had taken a church that was a dead church, virtually, and built it into a very vibrant, beautiful church in North Vancouver, and he did it. And this guy, it just drove him out of the church. And this man and his wife, they went out to lunch with us, and they sat there, and for 3 hours they talked, and finally, Scott can handle most anything, but after 3 hours, he couldn't handle the pressure anymore either, and it just, because it was just the unloading of their heart and the pain of their soul. They started a church over in the island, and I called them. I said, the only thing I implore you, I said, I don't know you that well, but I beg of you. Having walked out of the pain of this experience, do not try to keep yourself from being hurt again, because you will thereby destroy the relationship you have where you've gone. You see, so often we fail to do this because we're fearful of what will happen. We don't like the pain. None of us likes the pain. And I remember the reminder to me, and it didn't even come from a believer, but it was so true in my life. You know, when you brace yourself to keep from being hurt, you also keep yourself from being helped. Because in the process of hardening yourself to not let anybody get inside, then you see when people do want to come inside in a positive way to affirm your soul, you can't handle it because you are so hardened to anybody touching the inner part of your soul. I did that. And you could walk out of church and say, Pastor is a great message. Your pastor appreciate your ministry. And you know, it didn't make any difference because you see, just as you could not hurt me, so you could not help me because I'd hardened my heart to this for fear of being hurt again. Paul says, you know what? He says, I'm open with you and I understand what you might do with it, but you see, this is where it is. Open mouth, open heart, in the midst of a book of defense. Another thing that keeps us, and it does, all of us are affected by this. You notice, if you will, in chapter 7, his statement he makes there in that passage, he says this. Notice in verse 4, the last few words, I am overflowing with joy in all our affliction. Now, see, this is an amazing statement about Paul, because in the midst of all my affliction, I am overflowing in joy. You see, you walk into my life and you are bubbling with joy. See, you're so excited. And me, I am mega depressed. See, and you come into my life and you know, I don't want to get into your mode of joy. I want you to get into my mode of depression. Right? Okay, you don't do it, just the rest of us. No, anyhow. But see, it's an amazing thing of this, is somehow in the midst of whatever the struggles are of my soul, I can take myself out of that to respond to you in the midst of your joy. And it goes the other way too, does it not? Husbands, you come home from work so excited because something positive has happened that day, and you can hardly wait to get home, and you walk in the house to the most depressed state you've ever seen in your life before. Now, it didn't happen in my home, but it may have happened, you know, anyhow. You walk in, and you know, the natural thing somehow, and you've got, you know, they've got the children all day, and they've caused all kinds of problems, and they're waiting just to be rescued, and you walk in there, and you're no mode of rescuing anybody. And then what happens in the conversation later? But I came home so excited and you didn't respond to my excitement. Yeah, but I was so depressed and you didn't respond to my depression, right? We are so unbelievably selfish, are we not? And when we get together with people, we're bothered because they don't listen to us. And yet the question is, do we listen to them? And Paul says, somehow in the midst of all of my affliction, I'm able to respond to your joy. That's tough. That's tough. That's again the whole model of Jesus' life. Everybody else more important than you are. The other thing, you notice this in the sense of the selfishness is there, the fear is there. There's so much that comes with this business, and it's so much of that, but I just want to suggest to you, just as we conclude, because we'll come back this next week. You know, for many of us, we look at this and we say, you know what, it's not a part of my generation, but I guarantee you it's not a part of my generation. I had a great father, but I didn't necessarily learn this from him. And you can say, well, you don't understand, I'm German. Yeah, so what? Or I'm, you know, it's just sort of fun because you started this business and, you know, it used to be the Scots are the one who pinched the pennies, and then I met the Swedes. And the Scots don't even understand what the word means. No, anyhow, it's amazing kind of stuff like that because, you know, we do this kind of stuff and we think it's got to do with our background, our upbringing, whatever in the world it is. And we excuse this kind of relationship because we say, well, you see, I can't help it. This is what I came out of. This is what I am like. This is what we people are like. See, this is what our forefathers were like. You see, all of this is sandwiched around verses 14 of chapter 6 through 7, verse 1. And I got to tell you, just if you want to miss next week, you at least understand why you're missing. Because I got to tell you, the root cause of the lack of openness that we have with each other has not to do with our ancestry, has not to do with the upbringing. Paul says it ultimately has to do with sin. And for all of us, we need to come back to understand if this is what God expects of our lives, if this is what God wants to have happen in the body of Jesus Christ to make it different than what happens anywhere else, then you see, we better come back and deal with the root problem. And we can say, well, it's because of fear. Yeah, that's true. It's because of selfishness. That's true. But you want to take the bottom line issue if you deal with selfishness. What's the bottom problem of selfishness? It's sin, is it not? And I just want to suggest to you that this is what we need. This is what I need in my life. It's what I need in my relationship with my wife. It's what I need in my relationship with my children. It's what I need in my relationship with you. And by the way, I see my role as basically one who is about relationships, and I understand that that's what it's about, and in personal contact with you and others. And this is what needs to be. There needs to be an openness of mouth. There needs to be an openness of heart. There needs to be a support for one another. There needs to be a sense of a lifelong commitment. No matter what happens, we're there together to walk through whatever it is together. There's a need for this today. And I need to get down to the root problem in my life and deal with it so that I can have the kind of relationship that God expects me to have. So I pray for all of us as we examine our own hearts this week and next week that God will enable us to have this kind of relationship with each other, this kind of love, this kind of selflessness, this kind of freedom from fear that only He can give. God helping us. Let's pray.